From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America presents Issues in the News. The nation's top Washington correspondents offer their perspectives on the week's major stories.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Barbara Slavin, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor. Joining me on the show this week are Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to National Journal, and Tim Mack, senior congressional correspondent for The Daily Beast. And here are the issues. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu made a widely anticipated speech before a joint session of the U.S. Congress, but his critique of U.S. policy appeared to have had little impact on negotiations over a nuclear agreement with Iran, which are accelerating in an effort to reach a framework deal by the end of the month. Iraqi forces bolstered by Iran sought to retake Saddam Hussein's hometown of Tikrit from Islamic militants. The Iraqi government expressed frustration with U.S. calls for patience in such campaigns, and U.S. officials expressed concern that the operation, which also included heavy involvement by Shiite militias, would further alienate Iraq's Sunni Muslim population. Revelations that Hillary Clinton used a private server, ClintonEmail.com, for official electronic communications during her time as Secretary of State led to congressional subpoenas and questions about the presumptive Democratic presidential nominee's penchant for secrecy. And finally, in Russia, thousands attended the funeral of Boris Nemtsov, a democracy advocate and opponent of Russian President Vladimir Putin, who was gunned down near the heart of Moscow by a so far unidentified assailant. Well, Tom, let's start with Bibi Netanyahu. I'm tempted to quote William Shakespeare, a tale of full of sound and fury and signifying nothing. After all the buildup, what did he say and what did he accomplish?
Well, I don't know that he accomplished anything unless you believe that this fire and brimstone speech against Iran will help him in the March 17th elections in Israel. It's a very close election, and many in the White House who are enraged with Netanyahu say this was all for domestic Israeli consumption. But he basically said that the deal that President Obama is working on with the Iranians is a bad deal and that it should be rejected. It basically was implying that Congress should do everything it can to help torpedo this deal. But in terms of signifying nothing, you have a point, Barbara, in the sense that there's nothing Netanyahu can do to stop these negotiations. In a perverse sort of way, I was speaking to a former Secretary of State who knows a little bit about this the other day, and he said it may well be that this gives some emphasis to the talks because the Obama administration can now say to the Iranians, Congress is against you. Think about what will happen if this deal falls apart. Do you think you're going to get a deal this good from the next president or from any Congress that will insist on sanctions? And if the deal falls apart, by the way, there will be new sanctions imposed by Congress. So we will see whether that turns out to be prophetic or not. But you have to give it to Netanyahu in this respect, Barbara. He is a showman. Mm-hmm. References to the Holocaust, reference to Moses, reference to other biblical references.
Esther.
Esther, that's right. And he is a showman. Yeah. And I must say, and it's apropos really of nothing, but it was only 6 weeks ago where President Obama delivered his State of the Union address from the same podium in the same chamber of the House of Representatives. And I think it's fair to say his reception in that hall was a pale imitation of the reception Netanyahu got. Now, granted, the Republicans co-control both houses of Congress, and the Republicans wanted to, in their own way, embarrass Obama and also show America's great support for Israel. But Netanyahu did better optically than Obama did six weeks ago. But it's really an interesting situation here.
Yeah, I had an editor, Tim, at The Economist, who I wrote a story about Netanyahu once, and he put in front of Netanyahu's name the qualifier, the too mellifluous, Mr. Netanyahu, mellifluous as in smooth talking. And he certainly has a way with alliteration. tentacles of terror and so on, referring to Iran. My sense was that he was asking for the impossible. He was basically saying that Iran had to become another country before anybody should sign a nuclear agreement with Iran, even though some analysts afterwards noted that he didn't demand zero enrichment and there were, you know, he didn't call for war against Iran, which he has done in the past. Do you think it's going to have any impact on the negotiations or really on Congress?
Well, you know, I mean, I think the fundamental takeaway is it doesn't change the calculus of the landscape. It doesn't change the incentives the president feels he has to make a deal. It doesn't change whether Iranians are more likely or less likely to make a deal. And it doesn't change whether Congress is going to be able to approve the deal or reject the deal. All of that is on hold while the Iranians and the United States are in negotiations. So what does it affect? Two things. It affects his campaign at home. He's currently running a campaign, and a lot of this, it's hard not to say that it's not for domestic consumption. Secondly, what it does is it does threaten, I think a lot of Democrats have made this point, does threaten the bipartisan nature of the Israeli-American relationship. You saw during the speech, Nancy Pelosi, the House Democratic leader, shifting around uncomfortably, and after she released a very interesting statement, which
she said she'd been insulted, her intelligence had been insulted.
That Netanyahu had been patronizing Congress, that she was near tears by the way that Netanyahu had treated the Congress. And, of course, dozens of Democrats had decided not to attend the speech, viewing it as more of a political speech as opposed to something that would unify both parties. And so at the end, what it has done is it has had, from the Israeli standpoint, domestic and foreign effects, but mostly to the degree that it had political effects, not to change any sort of the fundamentals of the negotiations. Now, what Tom said was very interesting, that Netanyahu, at least in front of the audience in Congress, received a better reception than the president himself did. We actually tallied it up. He got 35 rounds of applause compared to the president, who got 21 during his State of the Union. So we're actually, there's like an actual quantifiable amount of applause that Netanyahu had greater than the president himself.
Yeah, but of course the
American Congress.
The audience was full of Netanyahu supporters. And some 60 Democrats didn't show up.
Fair enough.
Now, it may not matter to most Israelis, but for Americans who looked at the scene, I mean, you had John Boehner and Orrin Hatch, who was the president, I think the temporary president of the Senate, sitting behind him, where you should have Joe Biden and John Boehner. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the sense of bipartisanship, you know, certainly was not there. I've seen some other interpretations. Of course, people in Iran were following this speech very, very carefully. And it appears that it may help Iranians accept a deal, not just for the reasons that you mentioned, Tom, but because, you know, there's a lot of feeling against Netanyahu. He's seen as somebody who's hostile to Iran. And so if he hates this deal so much, i.e. it must be good, right? Ipso facto. So, you know, there is that as well, that the administration can say, look, you know, this is a pretty good deal and you guys should take it. In terms of the negotiations themselves, as I mentioned, they've got a sort of soft deadline at the end of March to have some sort of framework. And we will see if they get there. Tom, what do you think?
Well, I tend to agree with you, Barbara. You said on this program a couple of weeks ago that you thought that it was slightly better than even chance that there will be a deal. And I defer to your judgment on that. There's a couple of knowns and unknowns, to use former Secretary of Defense Don Rumsfeld's famous phrase. One unknown is the impact on the Israeli elections on the 17th of March. We'll know soon enough. But there is a known. And the known is that the relationship between the Obama administration and the Netanyahu government is very poor. And the unknown about that is how that will impact. I mean, we've discussed this before, but it's very clear from contemporary history that Israeli voters are uncomfortable when it looks like the relationship between Israel's greatest friend in the world is somewhat frayed. I remember in the 1980s, that the administration of George H.W. Bush got crosswise with Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir. They thought he was too much of a hardliner. They thought he was standing in the way of peace. And I remember that celebrated instance where Secretary of State Jim Baker went up to congressional testimony and gave out the number of
the White House
and said, if you're interested in peace, call us.
Yeah.
And the Israelis went a little crazy on that. But the point is, the punchline here is is that in the next election, Shamir's government fell, replaced by Yitzhak Rabin.
Right.
So we will know the domestic political impact in Israel soon enough, but there is no doubt that the Obama White House is enraged by Netanyahu. You don't get a lot of information out of this White House, and the opportunities to see President Obama by reporters are few and far between. But after Netanyahu's speech, there was a photo opportunity.
That turned into a press conference.
Many press conferences. It went on for 11 minutes.
Yeah.
President Obama talking about there was nothing new in the speech and basically went back into Netanyahu's face. So there is no doubt that there is political disagreement and personal animus now. And that makes some Israelis nervous, and we'll see how that sorts out.
If it has an impact. Iran is also in the news, Tim, for another reason. The Iraqis have decided that they want to retake the hometown of Saddam Hussein, the late dictator, and they've mounted an offensive against Tikrit using some of their regular forces, but also a lot of Shia militias, and apparently a lot of Iranian support, including the presence of Qasem Soleimani himself, the head of the Quds Force, the Jerusalem force of the Iranian Revolutionary Guards. This has caused some interesting comments in the United States. Some think, well, you know, more power to them if they can retake Tikrit, but others are concerned about the implications for Iran's influence over Iraq.
Yeah, I mean, it's deeply concerning to, for example, U.S. officials at the Pentagon, where they spent more than a decade working on Iraq, on issues relating to Iraqi security, and now they see Iran swooping in, expanding their sphere of influence, increasing military-to-military cooperation with the Iraqis, and essentially sending in forces to help the Iraqi military try to take territory back from Islamist militants. One of the most worrying things, I think, for American officials is not merely that the cooperation occurred, but it occurred without Americans being informed of it ahead of time, that they were taken off guard by this unprecedented cooperation. I mean, there have been increasing signs that Iraq and Iran had been cooperating on a military level, but something of this scale, of this magnitude, a full-scale operation in Tikrit, is something that American officials just weren't ready for. And in fact, if you compare the way that the Iraq and Iran have worked together this month with the total bungling by Pentagon officials saying that they were going to launch a spring offensive on Mosul and then pulling that back and canceling it, it seems like there's a very worrying disconnect.
We'll have more in just a minute. First, a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Barbara Slavin of Al Monitor. Joining me today are Tim Mack of The Daily Beast and Tom DeFranco of National Journal. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. The program is also available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/issues in the news. Tom, I want to continue on that note. What is going on in terms of U.S. military cooperation with the Iraqi government? How could Iraq mount an offensive like this without telling the United States in advance? And what does that bode for military cooperation going forward?
I mean, the military cooperation going forward will be there. The Iraqis cannot do it without American military support. The U.S. knows that, and the Iraqis know it. But Tim is right. There is a disconnect here. I mean, there's still growing pains in Iraq, a country that is still struggling after a change of power. And I believe that ultimately there will be some boots on the ground, more American troops in Iraq, in the Syrian campaign. I think the Tikrit offensive is basically, I think, a dress rehearsal for Mosul. And I think American officials believe that, to put it mildly, there are a few things to work out given the given the performance in Tikrit. But I think there will be bumps in the road, but it's in the U.S. strategic interest to help Iraq. And I think the U.S. government will increase its help, both financial and military, to Iraq. And I think the key to the U.S. Policy is to try to stabilize Iraq and try, as President Obama has said many times, to degrade and ultimately destroy ISIS. So we, the U.S., will be in this game with greater assets months ahead. Yeah. But it will be rocky and bumpy.
I like the notion of a dress rehearsal in a way for Mosul. Tim, I was at an event at the Atlantic Council where John Allen, who is the retired Marine general and the coordinator for this global campaign against the Islamic State, spoke, and he said that Mosul has to be very well prepared. Tikrit is largely depopulated. Apparently, most of the population has fled, but Mosul has more than 1 million people still in it. And he said it was very important not just to take back Mosul, but to be ready to govern it and ready with humanitarian relief, because the population of Mosul has been completely traumatized by its experience under this under the so-called Islamic State. And that was how he explained the reason for delay. Nevertheless, we do have this situation where the United States and Iran are both backing the same side, it seems, in Iraq. So is that giving Iran more influence, or is it too late to talk about that, given just the fact that the U.S. went in 2003 and overthrew Saddam?
Well, that is the powerful strategic question, not only whether the United States is de facto cooperating with Iran already in Iraq, but whether the United States is de facto cooperating with Assad in Syria or elsewhere in the region, that the United States has gotten entangled with its fight against ISIS. By fighting ISIS, it had to make some tacit arrangements with people it otherwise wouldn't normally make arrangements with, whether that's Assad or with Tehran. So the deep question is it too late? I mean, I think the Obama administration believes that, and you're an expert on this, is that the Obama administration believes if it can get a deal with Iran on the nuclear piece, that it starts to open up avenues for cooperation and strategic realignment all over the region, that it totally changes the way that the Middle East looks from an American perspective, that the United States and Iran can start talking about how to peacefully transition out Assad, for example, or to cooperate on defeating ISIS in Iraq. These are the things that they hope will come out of the long-term arrangement.
Yeah, Tom, but Secretary of State Kerry has been in Saudi Arabia, in a way, saying the reverse. He says there's no grand bargain with Iran. Don't worry, we're not going to abandon our traditional allies. We don't trust them. You know, there are a lot of mixed messages being conveyed here.
Well, that's part of the essence of diplomacy, trying to keep everybody off balance and trying to. I grant you, the U.S. has a difficult needle to thread here between domestic concerns, geopolitical concerns, strategic concerns. But basically, Secretary Kerry is trying to do a delicate dance here, and I wouldn't pay too much attention to this. If the Iranians can help us in Iraq, we don't have to like it, but we would be crazy not to take some advantage of that. And we'll have to see how that all sorts out.
Okay. Let's turn to a domestic story briefly. Tim, Hillary Clinton, her own email server. I don't know how many people have their own email servers. ClintonEmail.com.
That's right.
How big a deal is this, do you think, the fact that she used a private email server? She has now apparently turned over some 55,000 pages of emails that were connected to her work when she was Secretary of State. And there is a small army of lawyers at the State Department that's going through them to see what's relevant. She's also said that the State Department is welcome to publicize any of these emails if they think that would be helpful. But Washington Post had an editorial talked about her penchant for control and secrecy. And certainly having your own email server would seem to fall into that category, no?
Well, a few things. On the face of it, a story about email does not look inherently sexy. But I think that it has deep, deep potential to be dangerous for the Hillary Clinton proto-campaign or campaign for president or her political future. There is no way to explain why the Secretary of State would exclusively use a personal server and a personal email address outside the realm of the State Department for public business, unless it was to obfuscate those messages from reporters, the public, and from general transparency. So you can't explain the need to have a personal email address on a server located in your house, not secure like many other government emails are, without it being essentially saying, I don't particularly have a view for transparency. I want to keep my cards close to my chest.
Yeah, but how secure is government email? I mean, we had WikiLeaks after all, Tom.
Well, point well taken, Barbara, but government emails are more secure than a private email server in somebody's basement or living room or bedroom or whatever. The real problem here is what we don't know, and I suspect we'll never know, is how many thousands of messages the former secretary did not turn over to the State Department. And, I mean, I've covered the Clintons a long time. To say they have a penchant for secrecy is an understatement. They are obsessed with secrecy. And this feeds into the narrative. The Clintons always kind of straddling a fault line between crisis and disaster. I mean, this is not smart. And it's the old adage, I guess, because I came up in the Watergate era. You know, one of the things I learned about damage control from the Watergate period in American history is if you don't have anything to hide, don't behave like you do. And this just suggests that there is something she didn't want to see the light of day. And so this feeds into the narrative of the Clintons, Bill and Hillary, as being kind of coming right up to the edge, skirting the edge, and it's a problem for her. I agree with Tim on that. And for a candidate that probably has very smooth sailing to the Democratic nomination if she decides to run, and I think she long ago decided that she will run, this could be a problem in the general election. It's just another piece of baggage. There's probably 38% of the United States that would not vote for Hillary Clinton, even if she was canonized.
Sure.
But for those people, it really doesn't matter. This will hurt her, but they won't vote for her anyway. But there are millions of Americans who are either disaffected Republicans, centrists, middle-of-the-road independents, and I think many of them are going to say, what is this all about? And it's part of me says the Clintons have proved time and time again that they kind of have no shame and they can't be embarrassed. To me, of all the dopey things I've seen recently by one of the Clinton spokesmen said, this arrangement fulfilled both the letter and the spirit of the law. Well, maybe letter perhaps, spirit,
well,
no way.
We should point out that Colin Powell also used a private email when he was Secretary of State, and that, as far as I know, he hasn't turned over those emails to anyone. So,
fair point, but he did not run for president.
True.
And he has nowhere near the political baggage that Hillary Clinton has. So it's a bigger problem for her, whatever it is.
One more point, Tim, and that is that this comes on the heels of the revelation that the Clinton Foundation got a lot of money from foreign donors, which may be of more concern, perhaps, than the email scandal. But we have only a couple minutes left, and I did want to just mention Boris Nemtsov. He was an extremely active opponent of Vladimir Putin. He was killed just near the Kremlin. Who killed him? And what does this say about Putin's Russia?
Well, if I knew who killed him, it would be on thedailybeast.com pretty quickly, I think. But here's what it says, whether intentionally or not, and very likely intentionally, you cannot oppose Putin publicly. You cannot investigate the wrongdoings of the Russian government. And if you do, you will end up with 4 bullets in your back on the street. That is a clear, unequivocal message. Whether it was sent by Putin or someone close to Putin, that's the message that you get here. And for a lot of dissidents in Russia, this is the deep diminishing of any hope that they might have had for change.
Indeed, we don't know who actually fired the bullets, but there was a climate. There has been a climate created certainly in the last year since Russia took over Crimea, Tom, that you're either with us or against us. Yeah.
For all of his wealth, all of his newfound wealth over the years, Putin is a paranoid guy, and he is not going to tolerate dissent. I mean, it's hard to believe where Russia has come from and since the days of Mikhail Gorbachev and Boris Yeltsin. This is, in effect, a return to the Soviet state, and Tim is absolutely right. This was a message sent on behalf of Putin, if not directly by Putin. The fact that Putin announced that he would lead this investigation personally is not something to cause hope among dissidents. This was a message that this is what happens to you. And the fact that this happened within sight of the Kremlin, Red Square, I think that was an optic by design as well.
Well, that's all the time we have. Joining us today were Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to National Journal, and Tim Mack, senior congressional correspondent for The Daily Beast. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Barbara Slavin, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor. Thanks for listening.
From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Issues in the News. You can email your questions or comments to our panelists. Send them to voanews@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune in the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us next week at this time for Issues in the News.